This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last year, the movie Good Night and Good Luck focused on CBS News correspondent Edward R. Murrow's televised confrontation with Senator Joseph McCarthy in the 1950s. The issues included fairness, fear-mongering, and patriotism, and Murrow made his own views plain. 15 years earlier, Murrow was just as outspoken on radio in crackling broadcasts from Europe as crisis deepened into war.
This is London calling Columbia, New York. Now first, let's get in proper order the chronological developments of the day. At 9 o'clock this morning, London time, it was announced that a 2-hour ultimatum had been delivered to Germany, that at the end of that time, hostilities must cease, or Germany and Britain would be at war. At 11:15, the Prime Minister spoke to the nation. He stated that no reply had been received to the ultimatum, and that Britain and Germany were at war. Shortly after the Prime Minister's speech, the air raid sirens went off, and it wasn't a pleasant sound. We moved quietly and in orderly fashion down underground. The all clear came in just a little while. Now, for the last few hours, I haven't had an opportunity to be up on the streets of London to see what is happening. But I have heard one story concerning that air raid siren, and I think that story might interest you. It's told me by a friend of mine who was in Bond Street, and he said when the air raid siren went off, one man began to run. He ran for about half a block. He looked around, saw that no one else was running, and stopped, with perhaps the typical English desire not to be conspicuous.
Starting in 1939, Murrow's vivid reports explained the importance of developments in far-off countries, and particularly during the Blitz, the German effort to bomb the British into submission. Murrow brought the violence and emotion of war into America's living rooms. As this country debated isolation, neutrality, and intervention, radio in general and Murrow's reports in particular helped change American opinions. In a new book, author Philip Sieb says Murrow consciously worked to increase awareness of the threat of Hitler's Germany and support for Britain. For the man credited as the patron saint of broadcast journalism, the book raises serious questions about ethics, objectivity, and detachment. Considering the alternative, though, was there really a choice? And given Rwanda, Darfur, and the Balkans, what does Murrow's example say about taking sides in journalism? Later in the program, a heartbreak at the Preakness Stakes over the weekend. Andy Beyer will join us to talk about the disaster that struck Kentucky Derby winner Barbaro and the sport of thoroughbred horse racing. But first, the two sides of the Murrow legacy. We want to hear from you. If Murrow did help open America's minds to war, did he do the right thing? Does this change your view of him? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is talk@npr.org. Philip Sieb is professor of journalism at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He joins us from the studios of member station WUWM. His book is titled Broadcasts from the Blitz, How Edward R. Murrow Helped Lead America into War. And Professor Sieb, thanks very much for being with us today.
Glad to be with you, Neil.
As you mentioned in your book, and as I just mentioned, Murrow is revered in broadcast journalism. His reports set the standards for truth and for description and, I think you just used the words dark poetry. You say there's a lot more to it than that, though.
Well, that's right. And I think the book is really not meant so much to be a critique of Murrow as a challenge to the notions about objectivity. If objectivity is defined as not having a stake in the outcome, I'm not sure that's always the best thing, because Murrow, you could argue in his broadcast from London, certainly was slanting those broadcasts to portray the British people as heroic, to portray the Germans as evil, and to make it clear that if the United States did not come to Britain's rescue, first Britain would fall, and then the United States would have to face Hitler on its own. And so, you know, when the other side is Adolf Hitler, how balanced do you have to be?
Now, how many sides to that particular story are there?
That's right.
There were an awful lot of people in the United States at that time. A debate was raging in the United States at that time about whether to intervene in the war, whether to be a more active neutral, edging towards support of Britain, or the America First campaign to stay out of it.
Well, that's right, and certainly figures such as Charles Lindbergh and also Joseph Kennedy, the father of John F. Kennedy, who was the ambassador to London during part of this time, were urging that the United States stay out of the fight. They believed that Britain could not possibly survive, and they were more in favor of the United States figuring out a way to deal with Germany. For his part, President Roosevelt, his principal goal at this time was getting reelected in 1940, and you can see a big change in Roosevelt's policy going up to the 1940 election. He is not eager to commit the United States to any great degree to helping Britain. Immediately afterwards, we get Lend-Lease, and Roosevelt starts moving more assertively down the path toward war.
There's a magazine article you reference in your book, Hitler Threatens Europe, but Betty Haven's husband's boss is coming to dinner, and that's what really counts.
Well, that's right. I mean, there was an attitude in the United States at that time that the war was very distant, that just two decades earlier the United States had gone into the First World War to help Europe clean up its mess. And this time there was a kind of nonchalance about what was going on across the ocean, a feeling on the part of a lot of people that it would be very possible for the United States just to ignore what was going on, to ignore Hitler. And if Britain fell, too bad, but that was the Europeans' problem.
Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. And why don't we begin with Guy. Guy's calling from Valdez in Alaska.
Yeah. I watched that movie, Good Night and Good Luck.
Mm-hmm.
And they said something about him being one of the Wobblies.
The Wobblies, the nickname for the workers of the world.
WWW.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear more about his earlier life. And then what happened with him? I know he died of cancer, but wasn't he taken off the air too? And what would that man have to say about what's going on now? And with torture and just...
Guy, why don't we try one question at a time?
You bet.
All right. Philip Sieb, was Edward R. Murrow a Wobbly?
Well, I don't know about that. He was active in some labor work before he went to work for CBS. But he started very young. He was just in his late 20s when he went to London for CBS, really as more of an administrator and certainly not an on-air person. And then he ended up going on air just by accident. When the Germans annexed Austria, there was nobody else to broadcast. So that's when he did his first broadcast and went on from there.
And in the process sort of invented broadcast journalism.
Well, that's right. Murrow understood, as few people had before him and maybe not that many after him, understood the impact of radio and later, of course, television. When news came into people's living rooms live and accompanied not just by accompanied by sound and later by pictures, Murrow understood that when he could deliver stories about, say, an air raid on London and accompany those stories with the sounds of the sirens, the anti-aircraft fire, the bombs exploding, those stories would have much greater impact than just a newspaper story or a radio correspondent doing the equivalent of reading a newspaper story on the air.
Yeah, and yes, he was later taken off the air and later joined the Kennedy administration as the head of the Voice of America. But Guy...
That's right, and he died in 1965 at age 57. He was a four-pack-a-day cigarette smoker, and that's pretty much what did him in.
And I think it was Senator McCarthy who accused Murrow of being a wobbly, so consider the source, if you would, Guy.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
What would he have to say about what's going on nowadays? I mean, it doesn't seem like we have anybody that's in opposition to what's been going on, and I feel like this country is being run by the Nazis. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right, Guy. And I think, Philip Sieb, it's impossible to know what Edward R. Murrow would think about what's going on, but the broader point about Guy is I think, one of the points you're trying to make in this book.
Well, I think that as you say, it's impossible to know what he'd say about a specific issue. But Murrow's tradition does live on. I guess one example that comes to mind is Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times, who has been writing very pointed opinion pieces for several years now about the crisis in Darfur. He's made it clear that he thinks the United States and the United Nations should become more involved. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very clearly in the tradition of what Murrow was doing. So although Murrow has been dead for more than 40 years, that some of the principles that he stood for certainly are being carried on by other journalists.
It should be pointed out, Nicholas Kristof, of course, on the editorial or opposite the editorial page, it's an opinion column and it's labeled as
right.
such.
Yeah. Right, that's right. And that raises another question about Murrow. He was always, in his broadcast, he would sometimes sign off by saying, well, I don't want to give you my opinion. It's up to you to decide for yourself what you think about these things. But on the other hand, I'm here, I see certain things, and I want to let you know just how things really are. And there's no doubt that his broadcasts were very pro-British.
Here's an example. The Prime Minister to whom he referred in that first clip of tape was Neville Chamberlain. As France was in increasing difficulties and Norway was invaded, the British Parliament changed and it became Winston Churchill. And this is a segment of Edward R. Murrow's coverage of Winston Churchill's first speech as Prime Minister to the British Parliament.
Mr. Churchill believed that these islands could be successfully defended, could ride out the storms of war and outlive the menace of tyranny. If necessary, for years. If necessary, alone. There was a prophetic quality about that speech. We shall go on to the end, he said. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight on the beaches, in the fields, in the streets, and in the hills. We shall never surrender.
Edward R. Murrow broadcasting from London in 1940. We're talking about Edward R. Murrow and his role pushing America into the Second World War. And when we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Later in the program, Andy Beyer of The Washington Post will join us to talk about what happened to Barbaro in Baltimore on Saturday as he fractured a leg in three places and set horse racing back. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the fall of 1940, London faced waves of German bombers every night. During one raid, Edward R. Murrow of CBS News went to a rooftop in London to report live.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London. At the moment, everything is quiet. For reasons of national as well as personal security, I am unable to tell you the exact location from which I'm speaking. Off to my left, far away in the distance, I can see just that faint, red, angry snap of anti-aircraft bursts against the steel-blue sky. I was up here earlier this afternoon and looking out over these housetops, looking all the way to the dome of St. Paul's. I saw many flags flying from staffs. No one ordered these people to put out the flags. They simply feel like flying the Union Jack above their roofs. No one told them to do it, and no flag up there was white. I can see one or two of them just stirring very faintly in the breeze now.
We're talking with Philip Sieb. His new book, Broadcasts from the Blitz, How Edward R. Murrow Helped Lead America into War, says Murrow played a pivotal role in pushing the United States to enter the Second World War. And Philip Sieb, listening to that, not one of those flags was white. It's one of the things you're talking about, I guess.
Well, that's right, and it's hard even all these years later to listen to that and not feel kind of a chill. It's beautifully written, for one thing, and it gives you a sense of just what was going on as Britain was being pounded.
And it's important to remember that these broadcasts were live. There was technology to do recordings at the time, but it was very klutzy.
That's right. And Murrow wanted to bring Americans those attacks as they happened. He was the only journalist who was allowed to do so. No British journalist was even allowed to broadcast live during the air raids. And Murrow was only able to do it because his friend Winston Churchill intervened on his behalf with other British authorities.
I just wanted to, you were talking earlier about his use of that sound live in that broadcast. Listen to a later excerpt from that one air raid that Murrow reported on live from what we now know was the top of Broadcasting House in London.
Earlier this evening, We heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away. Just overhead now, the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. And the searchlights now are feeling almost directly overhead. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
Edward R. Murrow sounding amazingly calm on that rooftop in London all those years ago, Philip C.
Well, that's right. And when he talks about the bombs landing just a few blocks away, his home was just a few blocks up the street from where he was broadcasting. So, and that neighborhood took a terrible beating. And he and his wife stuck it out, though, for most of the time there.
Let's get another listener on the line. This is Serena. Serena calling from Sacramento.
Hi, Philip. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask Philip what he thought about, you talk about Murrow's dark poetry, and if you think that it was his poetic tone and like master words craft that allowed him to have such sway over people.
Now, that and his voice, not too bad there either, but go ahead, Philip.
Well, I think that was part of it. For example, on the first day of the Blitz, he talked about the fires up the river had turned the moon blood red. The smoke had drifted down until it formed a canopy over the Thames. The guns were working all around us, the bursts looking like fireflies in a southern summer night. People are going to listen to that, and you're not going to switch channels on your radio when you have reporting that is that poetic, really, coming into your living room. Plus, you combine that with the fact that he was always in the midst of the action, so it was exciting to listen to him as well. So I think that the combination of good language and just good aggressive reporting is what made Murrow such a prominent journalist at the time.
And do you think that language is necessarily rhetorically deceptive at some points?
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know, poetry is, you know, when you start talking poetically, it can be skewed to cause such emotion that people, you know, you don't hear in broadcasting today the kind of language he uses, you know, and sometimes I wish that we did, but, you know, it also, you know, I'm not sure that we would want it.
Well, I don't think you want it in every story, but and I don't think Murrow used it in every story. But there are times when the story is so important that you want to use the full power of the language to convey the importance of that story. Just as Churchill was said to have marshaled and mobilized the English language to describe the war and Britain's war effort, I think Murrow was doing the same sort of thing. He was trying to give his reporting more power and to increase its influence amongst his listeners, and I think he did that quite purposely.
Serena, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
You talk about Murrow obviously understanding the power of this new medium, radio. It was little understood by a lot of the people in positions of high power in both in London and in Washington. But you say that he was friends with both Franklin Delano Roosevelt and with Winston Churchill, and that they too, as I think evidence from the work they left behind, understood the power of radio.
Well, they certainly did. It was still a fairly new medium. Just 20 years earlier, there were only 30 radio stations in all of the United States. And so the growth of radio was tremendously quick. And as that happened during the 1920s and 1930s, people really hadn't stopped to figure out exactly what its political powers would be. Now, there were some people who were very hot radio personalities. The politician Huey Long, for example, used the radio with some success. But people like Roosevelt, for example, in his fireside chats, realized that the politician was coming into the living rooms of millions of his constituents. And he understood that when you get into somebody's living room, you don't shout at them. You talk with them. And that is something that Roosevelt and Murrow and to some extent Churchill all appreciated.
You also said that in a very real way, though an unspoken way, he was in a partnership with President Roosevelt.
Well, they both had the same ultimate goal, I think. I think Roosevelt early on realized that at some point America was going to have to defend itself against Germany and that it would be wiser to do so in alliance with Britain rather than doing so after Britain had fallen. But he faced certain political exigencies during the 1940 campaign that he could not be too overt about that support. Murrow, on his part, was moving down the same path, realized the same things, but didn't have the same kind of political pressures on him as Roosevelt did.
Hmm. Let's get another caller in. This is Ruby. Ruby calling us from Healdsburg in California.
Yes. No, I was in San Diego when the war hit. I was on the Enterprise before it went. Why it wasn't in Hawaii? It was all these ships were in San Diego because they were recommissioned. That was the end of the 30s, into the 40s, and that's why a lot of people don't realize it didn't go down in Hawaii. My father was on it, but he got off the ship, and so he didn't go down with it.
USS
lived to be 71.
USS Enterprise, of course. USS Enterprise, one of the few aircraft carriers in the United States Navy.
Right. I happened to be on it as a kid, and we had dinner there because it was being recommissioned. And all this, that's why a lot of the ships did not go down in Hawaii. The Pacific Fleet was in San Diego.
Yeah.
My sister was born there, so my mother was always listening to this stuff. And then we went to Norfolk, Virginia, so we were in the biggest base there. My mother worked for the war bond.
And must have listened to a lot of Edward R. Murrow during those war years.
And I did, but I also had a TV in the early 50s, so I did hear him a lot on the television and saw him.
What did you think of him? Well, you must have been just a kid at the time.
Well, no, but I mean, even when I got married, even in my 20s, when he was still doing stuff on the television, the beginning of television, you know, when news broadcasts were really good. And I don't say they're all bad now, but they're not done the same way.
No, they're not.
So I do remember hearing him. And I remember, see, my mother was born in 1910, so she worked on the war bond. She happened to have a good education. And we went back east. We went from San Diego to Portland, and then we got transferred back east.
Well,
we followed him.
Ruby, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate
it. Anyway, it was good, and he was good even up till he died.
All right.
No, I thank you. Bye-bye.
And Philip Seeb, December 7th, 1941, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Janet and Ed Murrow had an invitation to dinner that evening at the White House.
Well, that's right. They had come back a couple weeks earlier just to take a break from Britain. They were going to stay in the U.S., see some friends, spend Christmas in the U.S., and then head back to London. And they were friends with the Roosevelts, and they had set a date with Franklin and Eleanor to have dinner, quiet Sunday dinner at the White House on December 7th. The president was interested in hearing from Ed about how things were in Britain. And on the morning of December 7th, Ed Murrow was out playing golf when he heard the word about the attack on Pearl Harbor. Janet called Eleanor and said, well, I guess dinner is off. And Eleanor Roosevelt said to Janet Murrow, no, we still have to eat, so come on over. And they went to the White House, and it was a very small dinner. Eleanor didn't cook. The only thing she made for dinner ever was scrambled eggs, pudding, and milk. And so that's what the White House official dinner was that night for Eleanor Roosevelt and the Murrows. The president was in his study working through all this time, and when the Murrows got ready to leave, Eleanor said to Ed that the president wanted to see him. So Ed waited in the hallway for a while, finally got in to see the president, was the only journalist to speak with the president that evening, and he went in to see Roosevelt, and he said there was no question in his mind that the president had not known that the attack was coming. And the president also told Murrow that things were much worse in Pearl Harbor than the public had been led to believe. The president was particularly incensed about the fact that many of the American planes had been destroyed. They had never even gotten off the ground.
And upon leaving the White House, Murrow walks past the CBS News colleague, Eric Severide, who's there working. And Severide asked him, what'd you find out?
Right. And Murrow basically said it's real bad and kept on walking. And he never revealed that conversation until the conversation with Roosevelt, until the war was over and Roosevelt was dead. Roosevelt had never said, let's keep this off the record. But Murrow treated that conversation as a conversation with a friend, and he also had a sense that, great issues were at stake here, and he didn't just want to be running out and reporting what the president had said. He wanted to give the president more control over how the news was released to the public about this.
And he was then offered a job in the Roosevelt administration and turned it down.
That's right. He was offered a job working for the U.S. war effort, basically in propaganda. And interestingly, this is little known. The British had also offered him the opportunity to come and run BBC News. And he thought about that for a little bit as well. But he ultimately decided that his best service to all concerned was to go back to London and continue his work as a reporter.
We're talking with Philip Seeb, who's the professor of journalism at Marquette University in Milwaukee. We're about his new book, which is Broadcast from the Blitz, How Edward R. Murrow Helped Lead America into War. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in. T.C. calling from Cincinnati.
Thank you. I'd like to say thank you, Edward R. Murrow. Looking at the course of events and the timeline, who knows what would have happened if Mr. Murrow hadn't made it clearer to the American public what was at stake and what was happening. The previous caller speaking of comparing the current government with Nazism just makes me cringe. If it hadn't been for people like Murrow, perhaps the ovens would have been running in the United States. Hitler had plans on the entire world at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps Lend-Lease would have been not as vigorous. Perhaps the Manhattan Project would have been less successful. There's any number of things that could have happened that the war could have gone differently. There were no guarantees from the outset.
Mm-hmm.
And just thank God for Edward R. Murrow.
T.C., thanks very much for that. Appreciate it.
But
Philip Seeb, it does raise the question of, let's say that Murrow had a slightly different ideological bent. Let's say he had been persuaded by the Charles Lindberghs of the world that America First was the way to go, that involvement in the war was not the way to go. He was in a position of extraordinary power. He used it, and we now know, as you say in your introduction, that he was using it on the side of the angels, but he had extraordinary power, his to use, and it could have gone either way.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and certainly if Murrow had urged on the isolationist as opposed to supporting intervention, I think that would have had significant political effect in the United States because there was tremendous debate going on. It would have put even more pressure on Roosevelt, and who knows how Roosevelt would have responded if the isolationist sentiment had been even stronger than it turned out to be. So I think that underscores, again, the point of how powerful a journalist can be. I guess if you come a few years forward, there have been people who said that, well, Walter Cronkite during the Vietnam era particularly had that kind of influence. Well, maybe so. But I think it's something that journalists should take to heart, that their words don't just disappear out into the ether. People do take them seriously, and they can have a profound effect on public opinion and thus on politics.
Let's talk with George. George calling from Mount Hood in Oregon. George, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to say that I was 12 when the war broke out in England in 39, and Ed Murrow was part of the family, you could say. We tuned in every time we could to hear him, and it was a determining factor, I think, in the lives of a lot of people, and realizing what a threat there was over across the water. We'd seen Charlie Chaplin make fun of Hitler, and we'd seen comics make fun of various people who were part of the Japanese Empire, also Mussolini. And there was a long stretch where nobody really took him seriously. But to have that man standing on the building in the middle of the Blitz and feeding it to you live, that was a very powerful impact on the listeners. I don't think I'll ever forget it.
George, thank you for that. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
You know, Neil, that brings to mind what the writer Archibald MacLeish said about Murrow is, you burned the city of London in our houses, and we felt the flames that burned it. You laid the dead of London at our doors, and we knew the dead were our dead. I think that very well sums up the impact that your caller was just talking about how important Murrow was in American households at that time.
When we come back from a short break, we'll continue our conversation with Philip Seeb about his new book about Edward R. Murrow's broadcast from the Blitz. We'll also ask what happened to Barbaro. Horse racing's great hope for a Triple Crown suffered a life-threatening broken leg during Saturday's Preakness Stakes. What happened and what does it mean for thoroughbred horse racing? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. In a few minutes, a heartbreaking end to Wonder Colt Barbaro's quest for the Triple Crown and to his racing career. What does it mean for Barbaro and for horse racing? But first, let's continue our conversation about Edward R. Murrow and how his reports from the Blitz helped lead America into the Second World War. Our guest is Philip Seeb. He's a professor of journalism at Marquette University in Milwaukee and the author of Broadcasts from the Blitz. If you were listening earlier, we played excerpts of Murrow's broadcast at this time, and they are voice-only. It was not easy, indeed almost impossible, to go to excerpts of someone's speech or to use sound, but Murrow, in a new medium, did the best he could.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. The little traffic lights here, just a small cross on the normal globe, are now red. The cars pull up and stop. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet as they walk along. It's one of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights. Just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
And Philip Seeb, one of the things you have to remind us about in this book was the primitive, at that time, technology of radio.
Well, that's right. And Murrow did what he could with that. And he was very conscious of telling people, those are the sirens, here are the footsteps. And he mixed his language with those sounds. And he had a good sense of how that would be received in someone's home. People were curious, what's it like in London? What are those people feeling? What are they hearing? And Murrow did a good job of conveying that with the technology he had available.
Let's talk with John. John with us from Little Rock in Arkansas.
Yes, hello. I was just remembering the hard time that Murrow had later in his career after the war with the changes that went on in broadcast news with the networks. And I was wondering, being only 43 years old, I don't know a lot about what happened after that point. But, with the fact that a lot of hard news, and you don't see a lot of that on network broadcasts anymore, and you don't see a lot of people with the passion or the intensity of Murrow anymore. It seems to be confined to an earlier generation. What's happening to try to keep this type of tradition and spirit alive in modern broadcast journalism?
Well, of course, the big change that took place was that when Murrow was starting his radio journalism career, there were no expectations that radio news was going to make money.
Yeah.
And it became, when radio news started making money, and more importantly, when television and television news programs started making money, that changed the priorities for the organizations that own these networks, and that's why we've seen a dramatic change over the years in journalism. In terms of what's being done to maintain Murrow's standards, I think there are still plenty of journalists who are working hard and doing very good things. On the other hand, I think Murrow today would probably be appalled at how poorly the rest of the world is covered by American news organizations, and how much soft news has crept into the regular newscast. Now,
yeah,
he had to do some of that himself. Back when he was on television, he would have to do interviews with Marilyn Monroe and things like that. But I wouldn't write off today's journalism as being totally divorced from the Murrow tradition.
Especially with all those Murrow Awards for such things as set design. And it doesn't seem to fit in with the image, though.
Well, there's some trivializing, and Murrow's name does get used a lot, but I think it's very useful that we do remember him, and I think the movie, Good Night and Good Luck, served a good purpose just to get people to think about Murrow generally.
Well, I hope they don't lose his example and keep remembering what he did and the good things that he did for American broadcast journalism.
John, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate
thanks.
It. Ultimately, Edward R. Murrow, as you said, left CBS, and it was not entirely on good ground, and ended up working in the Kennedy administration on Voice of America, and he saw a role for government broadcasting. Indeed, that famous broadcast from the rooftop of Broadcasting House in London during the Blitz consulted about the idea of an American version of this after the United States entered the war. He said, there's no way to do that without giving away important information to the enemy. We should not do that again.
Well, that's right. It's interesting that another strange thing from someone you consider to be a very aggressive journalist, he said that, and I wouldn't want to report a war in which there was no censorship because I might make a slip and I might endanger some soldiers or sailors someplace. So it's good that there be some government oversight of what we're doing. But at the same time, when he was in Britain, he had some pitched battles with some of the British censors who tried to limit what he could cover.
Philip Seeb, thanks very much. We appreciate your time today.
You're very welcome.
Philip Seeb, a professor of journalism at Marquette University in Milwaukee. His book is Broadcasts from the Blitz, How Edward R. Murrow Helped Lead America into War. And if you'd like to hear more of Edward R. Murrow's broadcasts from London during the Blitz, you can go to our website at npr.org.